Thanks to Acast for hosting and monetizing the podcast.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Oh, hello there. Nice to see you. This is Let's Talk About Myths, baby! And I am that woman, your host, Liv. Here today with part two of my conversation with the oh-so-fun and knowledgeable Eduardo Garcia Molina. This was such a fun conversation. It was amazing just letting Eduardo talk about all of this. So much information just sitting in his brain waiting for a microphone. It's awesome. The Hellenistic period has never really interested me all that much because I've been so focused on the archaic and classical, but now, man, am I fascinated by these Hellenistic kings and their varied empires, the way they expanded and melded with local cultures, combined gods and traditions. It's all so fascinating. Turns out so much can happen over many hundreds of years. Like, who knew? A period of culture shock, the middle child, so many interesting ways of viewing and understanding this period, like, fuck, I love learning new things about the ancient world, discovering periods and ideas that I didn't know would be as interesting and appealing as they are. There's so much more than Alexander and Cleopatra to the Hellenistic period. So many hundreds of years in between. So much happening. So much to add to our understanding of the ancient world and the people who lived there, just all across the Mediterranean and beyond. Man. But again, why am I trying to explain about it when I could just play the rest of our episode? Conversations, Hellenistic kings, mythic callbacks, and cosplaying heroes. The Hellenistic period with Eduardo Garcia Molina. Because I did the basic Greek history in university, and I know that there was like two courses that were required under the program, and it was like pre-Alexander and post.
Yeah.
And
I hate that so much.
Yeah, it's like that's it. And then also though, the Greek history prof when I was at Concordia was like, the world's oldest man. Like, he should have retired so long before, and you could tell in every moment that he was speaking. And it's just unfortunate, because I think I had a great prof for Roman history, and it's so much more memorable, even though the Greeks are like my people, but it's just like the way it's taught. But
yeah, a lot of it has to do with teaching. And a lot of the times, especially for Hellenistic history, because maybe a department doesn't have someone that focuses on that, you'll get someone, you'll get like a Roman, an early empire scholar that has to do like a gen ed course. And they, of course, want to just like, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, get to that. So the period also suffers from in gen ed courses being seen as kind of a stepping stone, and people just also focus on the West. Because of course the Hellenistic period is not only a tale of the Hellenistic empires, but also the rise of Rome. And it's such a gravity well of interest there, because you have so much extant history that focuses on that from antiquity. Polybius is one of our main sources, like writing a history, because we don't have so many authors are lost to us. There's a Babylonian author that writes a history of the Babylonian period up to like, I know, but he's lost. I know.
The more I mean, that this is a constant, obvious like thing in my life, but it's like there's always a new one to learn about and be like horribly distraught that we don't have things.
What I would do for Berossos' Babyloniaca, you see snippets of it in like later Greco-Roman authors, because they have it, of course. They can reference it. So we can see snippets of it. But it would be so nice to have. But that's one of the things, studying the Hellenistic period is also a study of frustration. Because our literary sources are scant, and if they are, they're typically looking westward, because they're typically Greco-Roman authors. You have mainly it's Polybius for the histories, and then you have a bunch of inscriptions that supplant it. You have like Appian and other authors later on, your Plutarchs and everything, but they focus a lot on Polybius, especially. He states in the beginning of his history, he wants to focus on why the heck these weirdos in Italy have suddenly become a superpower in the Mediterranean. He says that, well, not weirdos. Weirdos is kind of implied in his wording.
I like it.
I mean, if you're a captive of Rome, and you're writing in the Scipionic circle, you try to massage it a little bit. One of my favorites, actually, stories, I forget what author this is, but the Romans are still consolidating in Italy, right? This is in the third century. They're talking with the people of Tarentum, which is a little town in, what's that part of the boot? Like the heel. In the heel of the Italian peninsula. And the Roman delegates are trying to speak Greek, because it's a Greek town. The Greeks colonized that in southern Italy profusely. It's what's called Magna Graecia. And the Roman delegates, they're negotiating like rights to sail their ships near their sea. And they're trying to speak to the representative of the town in Greek. But they fumble their words. Their Greek is not good. Their pronunciation is bad. So as they're departing the city, the negotiations break down. As they're departing the city, there's a story that a certain town drunk, I forget his name off the top of my head, he walks over to these weirdos in their togas, and he poops on the Roman delegate's toga. And I forget what the comeback is, but the Roman delegate just basically goes, you're going to regret this. And they do, because then later the Romans take over. The Tarentum actually invites Pyrrhus of Epirus over. So this is in the 270s. They invite Pyrrhus over to save them from Roman encroachment. So this is where you get like Romans first encountering elephants. You have a Hellenistic king attacking the Romans for the first time. Yeah, Italy is just the Roman Republic especially is a well that it draws a lot of interest toward. But they don't exist in a vacuum. Even in the second century, when they're expanding, they're still like interacting with these empires that still are a threat. Even after 188, the Seleucid Empire is still considered a threat. Antiochus IV has a military buildup. He has a military parade. An impressive one, 20 years after that treaty, where the Romans say you're not allowed to have elephants and stuff. He has elephants and he parades them around.
There's a Roman treaty that says you're not allowed to have elephants?
Yeah, because elephants are like, you know, in battle, they're scary.
I mean, no, that makes sense, but I just love that there's a tree that's like no elephants. That's the new rule. Yeah.
One of the stipulations is, you can't have elephants because it's like they're basically tanks.
Yeah, an unfair advantage.
exactamente. So one of them is, and they're also a sign of imperial power. They're a sign of royal power because
they're badass.
Exactly. Dang it. I forgot off the top of my head. I think one of the Seleucid kings had an elephant named Patroclus. And he was his favorite too. And he got like a silver cage or something because he was the only one that, I might be butchering this story, but I'm pretty sure the elephant was called Patroclus and he was given a like pimped out like carriage, the I forget what it's called, the thing on the back of the elephant. Gets a pimped out one because he was the only elephant that crossed the bridge and while the other elephants were too scared to or something like that. So he got a sweet. I'm pretty sure it was Patroclus.
That's precious. I mean, it's a precious story regardless, but I'll take that it's Patroclus.
Elephants are just like you have the Bactrian kings who have, I am fascinated by headgear because headgear says a lot about like what you're trying to be. And the Bactrian kings on these coins have a wonderful like elephant head on them, like an elephant hat. That's the skin of an elephant. And it's so like sweet on they have the tusks and everything. Because elephants project this like power. Conversely, to go back to the myths, Philip the Fifth. Oh my God. The famous Antigonid monarch who fought against the Romans and lost. There's a coin of his early on in his reign where he actually has Perseus cosplay. Like he has a winged hat on one of his coins and he's trying to be Perseus. He's embodying Perseus because that's how he legitimizes. He wants to point back because Perseus is tied with the Argive lineage at Argos. So he's calling back. So you have these like mythic callbacks that these Hellenistic kings are doing all the time. So Lucas has Apollo. I don't know if you're familiar with the Seleucus myth. So this is great. And these myths have a hold because we know a lot of them. For example, a lot of the Seleucus myths and the myths around like Antioch, we know from a guy called Ioannis Malalas. Yes. I always add an extra la. But he's writing in the 6th century CE, and they still like can recall these like local myths about their king. So one of them is that Seleucus the First, the founder of the Seleucid dynasty, his mom was visited by Apollo and they had sex. So actually Seleucus is the son of Apollo and he has a birthmark in his inner thigh in the shape of an anchor. So that's one of the myths. And then his mom gives him a ring that Apollo gave to her to give to her son to sit like, with this ring, you shall conquer. And he eventually conquered the East. So they build on these like mythic lineages. The Seleucid coins, very early on, you see Apollo on them. He's naked. He's sitting on an omphalos and he's like checking a bow. He's like inspecting a bow. And one of the cool things is that if you look at the Achaemenid coins right before the Seleucids, they have the Achaemenid king sitting on a chair with a bow, and it looks almost like Apollo later on sitting on an omphalos inspecting the bow. So you have to look at like how local people that lived under the Achaemenids, that have history knowing the Achaemenids before the Seleucids, how they looked at this coin that looked super similar to an Achaemenid king, like an actual Achaemenid king sitting there, but now you have Apollo. Like, do they think that's Seleucus?
Yeah.
And if so, you have the boundary between mortal and divine being super blurred, even more so. So it's stuff like that. Like, Seleucus also wrestled a bull. I forget where they were, but he was just chilling with a bunch of, you know, Alexander's posse, and a bull rampaged and almost gored Alexander, and Seleucus being Seleucus grabbed the bull by the horns and stopped it. And then in the 2nd century, you have people dedicating to a king whose lineage goes back to Seleucus. They give him a bull statue. Like these myths aren't just stories. They exist in the physical world. People put a lot of emphasis on them. And it's not only the Greeks, because other people are there. Most are now Greeks. Mm-hmm. But you see them interacting. They bring their own things. The Greeks bring their own. And you have this like hodgepodge, this wonderfully complex hodgepodge, which I think is why the Hellenistic period doesn't get enough cred, because it's lumped into this, oh, the Greeks just come in. Greek culture, the superior culture, is brought in. It enlightens everyone. And then you have the Romans, and then they bring their own stuff, yada, yada. But it doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. No, people coexist. People interact with it. The Greeks are just as recipient to local myths as indigenous people are recipient to Greek myths. Mm-hmm. There's not an imbalance of that. That's just not how people work, but that's how histories are written. Yeah. Because histories gamify everything. They want, these people come in. It has to be yada yada, mono everything.
So I'm curious, this, the work I'm thinking of is definitely not Hellenistic. It's later, but I feel like it is such an emblematic piece, I guess, of the Hellenistic period. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts on the Dionysiaca knownness. I mean, it's just like a wild epic, like the longest Greek epic I think we have, but I think it's from 4th century CE. So, but that's where we get, I think, most of the content on Dionysus and his like Indian campaign and Dionysus and all of that.
I see it as the product of the Hellenistic period. Because like we talked about with Berossus, this Babylonian chronicler, there in Ctesias with the Persiaca. Let me make sure. He wrote the Persica and the Indica, which is the Persica history of the regions in Assyria and in Babylon, and the Indica, a kind of, it's not like Pausanias with Greece, but it talks about India. Because Dionysus features so prominently in this conversation about the East and India, and you have all these authors that we no longer have that contributed so much to the Greco-Roman imaginary of what is going on in that region, that it's just a natural product. But of course, I would say that because I play 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon with the Hellenistic period. But it's true, because again, like we talked about in the beginning, periodization is moot. Things do not stop. Of course, the Greeks knew about the East before the Hellenistic period. But there's just so much more interaction on the ground, much more opportunity for that. Yeah.
And they'd gone further by then, though, too, right? Like, because were they familiar with India before Alexander? Or like, I mean, maybe
I would say yes, because the Achaemenids were. So through the Achaemenids, for sure, but not to the degree, because it really opens up. You have, heck, you even have inscriptions from like relatively close to India. You have bilingual inscriptions in Greek and local in. Yeah. So there's so much interaction going on. You have the Indo-Greek kingdoms. After Bactria kind of falls in the second century. Bactria is in Afghanistan. Ancient states. But in around those areas, in Central Asia. And there's wonderful scholarship, super recent scholarship being done on that, because that area is just yielding so much new information, so much in the way of bilingual inscriptions, coins with local script, where you have a very Hellenized king for these Indo-Greek kingdoms that pop up after Bactria falls in the second century BCE, and you have local script alongside Hellenistic imagery, like kings on horseback with the diadems and everything like that. But you have local script, and also you have temples. The temple architecture is a biggie, because they don't conform to traditional Hellenistic style temples. You see that they had the famous one is the one at Ikanum. It's called the Temple with Indented Niches, that shows local adaptation, local syncretism with like pre-Hellenistic local architecture. But then you have a smattering of like your Greek temple architecture, and you see these all over the place. Yeah. Well, not all over the place, but certainly you see them pop up. Mm-hmm. These temples that appeal to different value sets. They're not just spreaders of Hellenic cultures, as some museums in Greece, much to my dismay. Oh my God, I saw some little labels that just very, very adamant about spreading. And it spread, yes, but the wording on it is implying that, like, you know, it's some sort of manifest destiny or something. I've been doing a lot of, like, soul searching as to why the heck I'm drawn to this period. Mm. I think a lot of it, especially because, like, I focus on how subjects communicate with statal power in the Seleucid Empire specifically. And I think that's has a lot to do with how Puerto Rico is, because I was born there, how Puerto Rico manages under the power of the United States, and how you negotiate, how people, we in Puerto Rico, you use the U.S. dollar bill. In the Seleucid Empire, if you were under them, you would use minted coinage bearing their insignia, bearing their presidents, their kings. Mm-hmm. So it's stuff like that. How do smaller powers negotiate their position with a greater imperial power? And just like Puerto Rico, you coincide. People continue living. You still have local traditions, but you see meshes with the power that's dominating the area. That's why you have, like, super Spanglish and stuff like that. You see that in the language. You see that in coins and in the Seleucid Empire. You see the Phoenician cities with Punic alongside the Greek. You see them trying to translate their local offices into Greek words that make sense when they put on these inscriptions, like in the Ultimos inscription. They're trying to, one of the things is, how do we translate this local magistrate? And they come up with a Greek word. It probably is not a one-to-one, but a.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases, and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
It's so interesting, and it connects with, like, a lot of what I've talked about recently on the podcast, which is just kind of, like, obviously I specialize, or, like, I focus on Greek because that's what I know, but I also am, like, making a conscious effort to make sure that all my listeners, who are typically not academics, who are just, like, nerds who want to learn about Greek myth,
right,
and just make sure that people understand that the general broad modern and specifically like quote-unquote Western understanding of the Greek world is deeply biased and, you know, and makes Greece sound like this be-all and end-all of intelligence and culture. And yeah, and then like you're saying how like, you know, the idea of they just spread Hellenistic culture, you know, took over and all this. And that's nonsense. And, you know, and they even in the classical period and archaic too, they were, you know, interacting with other people. And, you know, the Mediterranean is a large place and Greece did not exist in a vacuum. And they had their own understandings of everyone else, their own opinions, good and bad. Yeah, it's just it's so fascinating to look at that. Like I said, I've recently looked at the general mythological understanding of Africa and just the way that I was interested to, I mean, and obviously this is, it's very Greek, but it seems to me somewhat specific to Africa or sort more widespread there, I guess, where they seem to have like really made an emphasis on Hellenizing, I guess, a lot of the things there of like, you know, the rivers had their Hellenic nymphs associated with them. And then they, those nymphs had the names, you know, that we know, like there's a Nile, Nileus, and there's Memphis. They basically like interact with the Egyptians and beyond, you know, who they called the Ethiopians, what they called Libya generally, and then developed like Greek stories to coincide.
Yeah.
And it almost makes me think that they wanted to like see them as less barbarian, I guess, than they saw a lot of other places, because they really made an effort to be like, no, they've got a lot of Hellenic background. Or, you know, and even the way that they made Io the founder of Egypt and also the founder of a lot of Greece, you know, and they were like, no, we see the Egyptians. They're pretty cool. They've got those pyramids. Like, let's make them Greek somehow in our mythology. And I just find that so interesting.
Yeah, that's just there's a big thing with mythic geography and the delineation of Greek space and the rationalization of local terrain, like, for example, terrain in Syria or something like that, how to mesh that with the Greek mythic imaginary. And you have some really good example, like going back to the Seleucus myths. One of them is he wanted to found a city. As all Hellenistic monarchs do, they really love founding cities.
Particularly in their mythology, too, so it connects all well.
Exactamente. And this is in Antioch, on the Orontes, so northern Syria, near the coast, near a city called Seleucia Pieria that I recently did an article for. And you have this mountain called Mount Cassios. Big old mountain. Okay, you go, big old mountain, sky god, Zeus. There's a myth that Seleucus was sacrificing on the mountain to see where he would found a city. And the myth goes that an eagle comes in, as they oft do, and grabs the sacrifice and plops it down where Seleucia Pieria is. And you're like, okay. And there's a cult to Zeus. You see this in the coins. They have a thunderbolt on a really plush cushion. Actually, it's like a really comfy cushion, that this the royal cushion. It's very nice on the coins. Pero new research has stressed that before there was this foundation, there was already probably a cult to a local sky deity. And these people did not just leave when, you know, Seleucia Pieria. No, they probably went to the city. They were given land, or they went into the city, or they settled nearby, maybe some redistribution or something. But they probably worshipped, they kept on worshipping whatever deity they worshipped before, and it coincided with this new, like, Hellenic identity. But you have these coins, and they're super proud of it. And it's more than likely that people saw the thunderbolt and they thought different deities. Mm-hmm. We, of course, because we have a lens, depending on your, this is one of the things, another reason the Hellenistic period suffers, in terms of scholarship, not anymore, thankfully, but it was it was a casualty of that divide that you see in classics, where they don't want to acknowledge anything else in the Mediterranean that is going on that is not Greek and Rome. And the Hellenistic period suffered because of this for a very long time. Now, thankfully, for example, I have my wonderful colleagues working at the Near Eastern Department and the Oriental Institute here at UChicago. It's one of the big draws why I went here, is because you can learn so much from these archaeologists, these historians, heck, these philologists that focus on Near Eastern things and contextualize a lot of the stuff that happens in these empires that has been kind of steamrolled through the predominance in classics and in ancient history as a, another field in line with this for, oh, Athena is meowing in the background. Yeah, but this emphasis on Greeks and the Romans, that really tinges the conversation in a negative way, because it erases a lot of people's lived existences and how they saw themselves working within this new environment. They survived. They rationalized their own things. Myths continue. People kept their local beliefs. You can have people coinciding with different beliefs. I know that is harder to say nowadays, where everything is becoming so como que se dice, divisive. And that's not to say that there might not have been instances of violence. That's not to, again, this is not a hand-holding. There is still problems. There is still, the state still has arms. There is revolt, especially in Egypt. There's a lot of indigenous revolts. But still, people continue to survive and hold on to their beliefs. Beliefs change. They adapt to new things. You rationalize them. It's not just, oh, you see Apollo on a coin, I now worship
I
Apollo.
I worship Apollo, yeah.
Exactamente. Apollo. Exactamente. Yeah, and current research is shedding light on this. It's one of the wonderful things about studying it now is that you have so many options for, and even, heck, even general books are now popping up that seek to ameliorate this problem of a heavily Western Greek and Roman bias. And it's so dynamic and so fun. Stephanie Langenhooper, a wonderful scholar, she just recently released a book on miniatures, like miniature figurines that children play with in Hellenistic Babylonia. Yeah. And, cool. And you see, yeah, exactly. And you see like references to Greek goddesses alongside local divinities. Mirabile dictu. These two things can happen. People can see different things in different objects.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the same object, excuse me. Yeah, I think that's why it's so fulfilling to study this. Because you can still be interested in like Greek mythology, and you can approach it through that lens, but you can see how people respond to it if you want. Just like if you're someone that does like a Near Eastern scholarship, you can totally look at it from the other side. That's one of the good things about Hellenistic history is that more and more scholars are incorporating dialogues that are occurring in fields like Near Eastern history, archaeology, everything like that. A lot of it is driven, again, because we don't have much sources, much literary sources.
Yeah.
And somewhat thank God for that, or else we wouldn't be so heavily invested in all of this. I don't know. Mm-hmm. There's more. It's a really, it's not just Alexander and Cleopatra.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much stuff in between, so much weird stuff. The Satanic Panic in Rome with Bacchus.
Ooh, do tell.
So there's this super, I'm sure some Roman historian will chide me for calling it the Satanic Panic, but it's so fun. There's an inscription called the Senatus Consultum de Bacchanalibus, the decision of the Senate concerning the Bacchanals, the worshippers of Bacchus. And this is in 186 BCE, it's published. And it's these conservative Romans, like you think of your Cato the Elders or something, your hardcore conservative traditional Roman value Romans, panicking because these Greek cults are coming in and people are worshiping Bacchus and they're having these rites at night and we don't know what's happening. They might like be plotting to overthrow the state.
Pentheus at all.
Yeah, it's like the fire festival, but like a political fire festival. And so you have this like freak out moment in 186, and it's 186. So it's like Rome is still dipping its toes into the world of the Hellenistic East. So you have this like backlash where you have this consultant, this decision of the Senate that goes like, hey, you can't meet at night. Parties can be no larger than so-and-so. Like, they're super worried about this new cult. And a lot of it is tied, this is one of the things that I focus on too, on perceptions of the East as corrupting, as wealthy, and as sexually deviant. Exactly. They're seen as passive, soft things. They're subservient because they're under kings. So they naturally must. There's a lot of like geographical thinking also that the heat is what causes them to be soft and compliant.
Interesting.
See, pero, yes, but you see like 19th century histories latching onto this. This notion, like this Greco-Roman notion of the East. This is especially clear when you talk about like the Roman emperors. The ones that come from the East, they generally get a bad rap. They get dragged through the muck. In ancient sources, they get called like feminine, sexually transgressive, and other things. And it does have this association with, just like they see the Germans as a bunch of, the Romans see the Germans as a bunch of weirdos with big beards that like, keep to themselves, that don't interbreed with other tribes or something like that, so they keep their fighting prowess. And that gets taken to dangerous levels later on when you have 19th century German scholars looking at this and going, racial purity is what made... There's a wonderful book by a scholar. It's called A Most Dangerous Book, and it deals with Tacitus's Germania and how Tacitus, this Roman author, talks about Germany and talks about like these weirdo Germans who keep to themselves and keep their race pure, and that's why they're strong. And then 19th century German authors, hot off the heels of like German nationalism, you know, this is the time when German unification happens, they're looking for past history, they're looking for something in antiquity to make a German people unite under this new nation state, and they look towards that, and that's when stuff starts getting real dangerous. But the East has a similar thing. The barbarians in the north, they're hardy weirdos, they're hairy, they put butter in their hair to make it shine. I don't know if you've seen 90 Day Fiance, but that always makes me think of Big Ed with the mayonnaise in his hair. It's so gross. But the East has a similar thing where you have the, and you can still see it somewhat, like they're corrupt, they're exotic, they have all this money and wealth, and that naturally leads to like they're fat or they take on multiple partners, they let themselves be penetrated, they hoard all this money. And you see this in like Hellenistic Ptolemaic kings, they get depicted like this all the time.
All I can think of is 300.
I feel like exactamente.
300, is like a perfect example of all of that.
See, exactamente. Heck, if they did a 300, they wouldn't do it. But there's a Battle of Thermopylae, Antiochus III versus the Romans. It's not 197. It's in the 190s. Forgive me, I forget off the top of my head.
But it happened at Thermopylae?
Yeah. Right there. Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you read the accounts of it, Antiochus kind of puts himself in the position of the Hellenic, like the Greeks, and the Romans are kind of portrayed as the weirdos that are invading. So there's kind of like a duality. But that also happens. There's a very famous invasion of Gauls that occurs in Greece, right, in the 270s. This is like a moment in time. You have this Gallic invasion that goes all the way to Delphi.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. There's a battle at Thermopylae. There's a league of Greeks that try to stop them at Thermopylae. They're successful somewhat, but then there's some forces that reach Delphi. This is in 279 and 8. Mm-hmm. And then there's another little branch that goes into Asia Minor, and they eventually become the Galatians that dwell in central Asia Minor. And the fun thing is that these Galatians later get beat up by an Attalid king. So the Attalids are the ones that are in Pergamon. And then you have the the Altar of Pergamon, the famous Altar of Pergamon, right, under Eumenes II in the 2nd century BCE that gets constructed. And you have this battle against the Galatians in like the 240s, I believe. And it gets recast as the Gigantomachy. So, yeah, so the Pergamene king, which I believe is Attalus I at this point, it's not Philotidus, Attalus I defeats the Galatians, right? And the Attalids are set up as the Olympian gods, and the Gauls are set up as the giants. There's a lot of cosmology also that gets tied into Hellenistic kingship. Yeah, like Antiochus IV has that parade that I mentioned a while ago. He has a wonderful parade at Daphne. And it's kind of like a celestial cosmology. He has a lot of different gods that show up. Day and night are represented. And he's at the head of it in this incredibly lush procession. And there's a lot of like symbolism for like Hellenistic kings being the cosmos. They're the order bringers. They're the ones that you need. A lot of it is tied to, yeah, notions of Greek mythology, but also Near Eastern mythology, because the empires that came before that, of course, use similar things. They were the order, the Assyrians and the Achaemenids, that were the order, and everything outside the empire was chaos. So a similar line of thinking. So everybody in that parade could like get a grasp of what was going on. You did not need to be up on your like Greek mythology to figure out what the heck is going on. Yeah, it's just one of those things that's lost, I guess, in translation and in superficial readings and but we love our clean and nice histories. The problem is that history doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is why every academic gets called a spoil sport or something. I don't like Alexander. Oh, no, I must want to cancel him. No, I just want people to realize that he is a privileged son of a king who got one heck of a great army behind him. Of course, he was a great general also. But still. He did some bad stuff. as the people of Tyre, 30,000 roughly people got sold into slavery. Like, whoa. we have to keep things balanced. We can't fall back to this like hero worship. And you see this with like your Bezos and your Musks, where they like and what's his face, the metaverse guy.
Zuckerberg.
See, they see themselves as like Augustus or and there are interviews that they.
Yeah, I mean,
and Alexander.
Zuckerberg have a classics degree?
See, we don't talk about him. there's a lot of things I could say, but Bezos especially, I believe he's the one that like called Alexander forward.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit RightRug.com. That's RiteRug.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
I mean, Hellenistic statuary is amazing. Like, I feel like that's what I've always known about the Hellenistic period is, like, their statues are on fucking point.
Everybody knows the Roman copy of a Hellenistic original is the thing. You have the Dying Gaul. The Dying Gaul commemorated four battles against the Galatians and set up for that. But it's taken so far from the context, the Hellenistic context. And it's just a Roman copy of a Hellenistic original. And that's all that people see.
Yeah. And so what do you, like, I'm just curious on your thoughts on that exactly. Like, do we think that it's not, wasn't a Hellenistic original? Or are you just thinking the idea is what they see is
it's the labeling. The labeling of it. But the Romans were super fascinated by Hellenistic art and Greek art in general. Like, you have the Siege of Syracuse. The Romans famously plundered all the art from Syracuse and they brought it back to bedeck Rome. So many instances in the second century of just Roman generals campaigning in Greece and then taking anything that they want and bringing it back to Rome. It's this, like, artistic merit. A lot of those were also classical. It's not just only Hellenistic stuff, but the Hellenistic period is one of the most fascinating periods in terms of art because you start seeing statues representing people outside of, quote unquote, and these are big quote unquote, the norm. You start seeing people with body types that are different. Mirabile dictu. You start seeing, for example, some really wonderful statues of, like, an old drunk woman just, like, crying next to her jar of wine. And, like, the wrinkles are there. Her face is, like, it's so different from, like, the Corée or something. Just, like, the expressionless, serene face. You start seeing one of the problems is that there's a lot of terracotta statuettes that are labeled by museums as grotesque because they don't conform to our notions of, like, a healthy body or something like that. Disability studies have got an incredible way at length to really break them down, like, and try to see, like, there's one where a woman has a very exposed, like, skeletal chest. And she's also very long. It's a terracotta figurine from Asia Minor. Yeah, she's very, like, tall and lanky. And it's just labeled as a grotesque. But it could be someone living with a disability that people just, museum curators or something back in the day, the identifiers just called this a grotesque. But there is a fascination in the Hellenistic period with depicting the human body in a lot of different shapes and sizes. And I think that's one of the merits of it, and just like, there's so much there. You have Himbo Heracles, of course. You have depictions of the Minotaur. There's just, yeah, Hellenistic statues are just great. And we've lost so many because there's so many inscriptions that we're supposed to have a statue or something, and then the statue gets lost or reused or gets, I don't know, melted down.
That's the thing I was going to say. You think about the bronze alone, like how little bronze we have versus how much we know they made of bronze is wild and sad.
Yeah, and we think about these big statues, but there's also figurines, like I talked about with Dr. Langenhooper's research on Hellenistic figurines. But we see them in Ptolemaic Egypt, in Asia Minor, especially, also some in Syria. You just see, like, local gods chilling alongside, you know, the Greeks. And there's so much there in so many ways. And it's just really crazy to think about someone looking at a statue of I don't know, that old drunk woman or something, and finding something there. Yeah, let me see.
I need to find it. She sounds like my future, and I love it.
She's
like hanging on to wine.
Like, I think the statue, old drunkard, is what the statue is called. Oh my God. It's not me like giving air, old drunken woman. But she's just like looking up. So yeah, if you, the Wikipedia thing for listeners, if you just search like old drunkard Hellenistic statue or something, that's the actual Wikipedia page, is old drunkard. And of course there's two marble copies.
Oh, I love her.
Right?
Wow. Oh.
And apparently she may have ties to Dionysus, as a worshiper of Dionysus, because she does have some like stuff in her hair and stuff like that. So she could actually be a worshiper of Dionysus. Maybe nipped a little bit too much. Haven't we all? Back in my bachelor days, when I was doing my BA, yeah. Lord knows that was me many a nights. But yeah, like there's a fascination with like the human form, and you see this on coins too. Like Hellenistic, like a lot of people make a big deal of Caesar being portrayed on Roman coins realistically. You know, with that turkey neck he's got dangling. Mm-hmm. But that happened. That was a large product of the Hellenistic period. Starting with Alexander, you have depictions on coins, of course. But then you have like individualized, like super well. They're idealized portraits, of course. They're showing us what they want to show, so there's always that caveat. But still, Antiochus Grippos, one of the Seleucid kings, Grippos meaning hook nose. He has a very prominent, like, hooked nose. And you see that on the coin.
Cleopatra's is like that too, right? Yeah. There's a lot of references of, yeah, she has like a very prominent nose in her coins. It's so interesting.
Yeah. You start seeing like this shift towards like the ideal. Or at least like a more vivid representation that has there's so many things you can say about it. If I'm like, what do you think that's trying to say to the subjects? What's that trying to communicate to the subjects? Like, what picture of a king or a queen are you trying to do there? I also had this story lined up. There was no like way that I could. I was trying to see how I could. Como que se dice? Do a what's it called? Like a transition into this story. Another great thing about the Hellenistic period, you have a bunch of inscriptions. You see things like traveling doctors. Because of this interconnected, like, the poleis of Greece and Asia Minor and Syria are all in dialogue. They're sending representatives and everything like that. You see doctors that go from city to city, and they get honorific degrees. So-and-so helped this city in the time of praise, so they put up this. There's... like the civic nature of Greek cities changes somewhat. They become more interconnected into this network. That's a word that everyone loves to throw out. Network, network theory and everything. But they're right. And one of my favorites is, it's a dedication. Let me see if I can remember her name. Oh, Aristodama of Smyrna. She gets a dedicatory inscription, an honorific inscription set up by the city of Lamia. This is in Thessaly. They set up an inscription honoring her because she is actually a wandering poetess. And she goes from city to city. She composes epic poems and she sings them. And she did such a good job of singing about the local lineage of the city, the local myth of the city, that they set up this honorific inscription for her, tied up probably with a statue. And they give her a bunch of rights, like she had the right to be a citizen there. She could own property, and it transferred to her family. So, but you see this happening, like that story that I told about that Antiochus invited a poet to come to Antioch and to do a commentary on the Iliad. You start seeing more and more networks and the movement of peoples and guilds and stuff like that in this period, especially. Not to say that this did not occur before, but you just start seeing it more. Because there's more shifts, there's more interactions, there's more accessibility. Things have opened up more in terms of communications. And it's just a natural byproduct of just an expanded Eastern Mediterranean, especially.
And I'm sure just technological advancements, too, just given the time period and how much had changed over like so many hundreds of years from, the archaic period to Hellenistic.
Oh, this is one of my wonderful advisors, Alain Bresson, talks about this. He's an economic historian. He talks about, there's this debate going on about how much actual technological advancement there was. Because you see some like, one of the big things that you see, there's a lot of military innovation. I don't want to say technological advancement, just innovation, different things being tried out. You start seeing huge boats. Like Hellenistic navies is a thing. One of my professors in undergrad, William Murray, he wrote a book on just Hellenistic navies and how they push the limits on, like, you have your bog standard triremes, yada, yada, Athenian Empire, yada, yada. But then you have, like, one of the Ptolemies does, like, a huge 40, like, rower one that, like, carries, I don't know how many people on, like, this super barge. It's, like, something right off the History Channel. Yeah, you start seeing like archivization, you start seeing a lot more increase in like literature being discussed and written down and handed out. In terms of technological innovation, that's something that, it's one of those tricky things because it depends so much on the area and all that. Not leaps and bounds from the classical period. It's more, I guess you could call it, it's just hard to pinpoint.
Yeah, but I mean, and maybe it's just more of a matter of they just wrote more things down, and I mean, hey, great, or like inscribed more things or what have you.
Yeah, there is a boon in literary culture, and facilitated. So yeah, like one of the things that I work on is like seals and stuff like that in archives, and you can see it in the coins and stuff. You can see how. There's more like an increase in the artistry of the coins. A lot of it also has to do with just increased awareness of practices already prevalent in the Near East and everything, and that being brought out. Such a good period. Again, I'm a biased source, but still. Then you have like, Cybele is like in this period. The Second Punic War is when you get the black stone, quote unquote, being transported to Rome. If you even want to look at it from a Roman centric, if you want to stay on the Romans, which you're more than welcome to do, as someone who's interested in this period, there's nothing wrong with that. I say that with a slight tinge of
you're talking to the right person.
You have these like quote unquote Eastern cults being brought into Rome, and the fun thing is that they bring her in. She's a Phrygian goddess, of course, and they don't expect these, for the Romans, weirdos, these priests of hers, right, the Galli, practice self-castration. They wear makeup. They sometimes shave their legs, and they don't expect those to come along with the goddess. So it's kind of like a culture shock. But this period is also one of culture shock, like the Greeks pooping on the Roman toga and stuff like that. Like, Rome just doesn't like kick in the door into this period. Like there's struggles. It changes Rome just as much as it changes the composition of the East. And so much of Rome afterwards is attributed to the Hellenistic kingdoms. Like the cult of the emperor finds purchase in Asia Minor because they knew Hellenistic kings. Appeals to myth and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. They were like ready for that
already. Yeah, exactly. They more easily deified and it is still the subject of debate. Of course, everything is subject to debate, but the Roman emperors found greater divine purchase in these places where there was already a rich history of rulers co-opting myth and co-opting like their divine nature to justify their rule. There's so much precedent for Roman rule in these areas that get glossed over, because again, this period is like the middle child. People just want to get rush through it to get to, I don't know, Augustus or something. Mm-hmm. Cleopatra. Again, that's why, like, I understand why books in the Hellenistic period often use the, like, a little subtitle or something from Alexander to Cleopatra. But that's always bothered me to some extent.
Yeah. Like, it's catchy, but then you're more likely to, like, ignore or gloss over the in-between.
Exactly.
To get between those two.
Yeah, like, not every king looked back at Alexander. Mm-hmm. And not everyone that looked at a coin of a Seleucid, of a Ptolemaic, of a Antigonic king, and saw a youthful king with curls thought immediately Alexander. It's just one of those things that you have to be wary. Because, of course, Alexander features prominently. But features prominently to who? Because we transplant our own value sets when we come up with these theories. Like, oh, Alexander, like, people would have known. It's like, you sure about that? Like, how many would have known? Maybe they just thought he was super good looking and, like, had really sweet curls. Like, not everyone goes, aha, reference to Alexander. Yeah, it's just one of those things that you have. It's the ghost of Alexander that is pernicious. And then you have just, like, the people just want to go down to Cleopatra because she's so famous. And she encapsulates so much of the Hellenistic. You have a queen. Queens figure so prominently in the Hellenistic period. It's one of, there's wonderful scholarship being done now. There's wonderful conferences on, like, just Hellenistic queens. Because they get put in positions of power because you have royal families now. And once you have royal families, of course, the queens decide, the queens bring up children. They decide on policy. If the child is not old enough yet to take the throne, they can kill the child if they really want to, which is how, or they can kill their husband and take over. There's so many dynamics there. And Cleopatra encompasses, like, she knows so-and-so languages, seven languages. She's a polyglot. The Hellenistic period is one of intense interaction between languages, not only Greek, but, like, Aramaic and Greek, and local Indian script on Greek, Greek, quote-unquote, Indo-Greek coinage. There's just so much there for and I see the allure. I just wish people would stop, or at least give them a break. Like, they've earned a rest. Talk about another Cleopatra. Cleopatra Thea, my boo. She's wonderful. She, like, leads. She does so much stuff. She's always in the wings working on stuff. Greco-Roman authors hate her. I sound like an ad for, like, one of these pop-up ads.
The queen nobody wants you to know about.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. And they conform so much, again, to this, like, notion of, like, sexuality and the East and this, like, inverse of the male-dominated structure of the Greeks and the Romans back home. Men become women, women become men. That is a thing that Greco-Roman authors, like, latch on to. Yeah, if you stay in the East too long, you become Antony, for example, as Augustan propaganda would have you believe. You become luxurious and soft and effeminate. You put on makeup.
Oh, it's also interesting. But this was incredible. This was such an incredible conversation. It is very rare that I talk to anyone this long. Oh my God. Thank you so much.
No, of course. I had a ball. Again, rare that I get to wax poetic about this if it's on, like, a conference or something.
It's a thrill. This is my favorite part of the job, is when I just get to get academics talking. Editing it afterwards is my less favorite part, but
good luck with that.
I know. God,
I can't even imagine.
Well, this is gonna be two episodes, which is great. It gives me one question. I'll take it.
Perfect.
Is there anything that you want to share with my audience or promote or anywhere you want them to follow you? Anything at all?
No. I have a blog, but, like, I don't update it that much. I, like, shitpost on Twitter.
There's a lot of otter.
There's a lot of otter content. some thirst tweets from now and then, ancient thirst tweets, some like lewd martial poetry that I do from time to time. But like, yeah, no, I'm just a graduate student in his fourth year who like really likes to talk about this stuff. Yeah, I don't have like a mixtape or anything. Yeah, I just like talking about this stuff. So, yeah.
I mean, I'll take it. I love it. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
No, of course. I had a delightful time.
Ugh, once again, thank you all so much for listening. This part of my job, man, it's the fucking coolest. Also, I'm recording and editing so many things so far in advance right now that I'm kind of lost in all the episodes and conversations. Just no idea what things I'm saying repeatedly, like back to back. So when you hear this, I'll be in Greece, writing my novel and only vaguely working on the podcast. So make sure you're following me on Instagram for pictures of me in new and exciting places. I'll share some facts maybe when I remember. Ideally, I'll do an Instagram live or two. Again, when I remember because I'm shit at remembering. But pictures? Ugh, I remember to take and post pictures, that's for sure. I might even record an episode over there. We will see. In any case, that's all to say, here's another instance of me waxing about how much I appreciate you all for listening and helping this to be my job, for loving conversation episodes and wanting to listen to me listen to scholars tell me everything that lives inside their brains. It's so, so much fun, and I am so, 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 so grateful that this is my job and life. Like, what the actual fuck, you know? Anyway, this was such an incredibly fun conversation to have. I mean, so fun it's two episodes. That's a real feat. It was also interesting and insightful. Like, I learned so much about the bits and pieces of the Hellenistic period. I couldn't bring myself to cut out, like, a half an hour of it. Hell no. Two episodes it is. Now, as much as he didn't ask you to, I would highly recommend you follow Eduardo on Twitter. Not least because he's incredibly funny and shares lots of otter photos. There's a link in the episode's description. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians. She handles so many things, just like everything, you know? Especially while I'm away. She's a true lifesaver. Absolutely love Michaela. Our intern is Grace Roby. She's helping out with loads of things as well. But again, when I'm recording this, she hasn't started, so I can't be specific, but I know she's going to be great. The podcast is hosted and monetized by Acast. Nerd stuff. Am I right? Who doesn't love learning for free? Isn't that what makes podcasts just the fucking coolest things? Thank you all so much for listening, learning along with me. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. visit RightRug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.